It's only one piece of the puzzle. They can be very powerful tools, but tools don't build themselves. You know, you need the skilled craftspeople to know how to use the tools. You need professional education. The users have to be trained in how to get through the firewall and use it appropriately. The costs and benefits associated with the firewall have to be weighed. I mean, these things are not cheap to do well. And firewalls have to be adapted over time. So essentially, effective protection requires this holistic approach. And firewalls are a tool, but not the whole approach. This is where we normally pause for coffee.
Been around about, well, pretty close to an hour, so I'm going to have a small drink of Diet Pepsi. Ah, that was good.
Moving right along. Okay, I'm going to start talking about firewall and internet security basics. Okay, and this is just a list of the different subjects that we're going to talk about.
Yes, sir. There's one other thing, in addition to social engineering, built cryptography policies, there's a notion of rubber hose cryptanalysis, which is you find the person who has the key and you beat them with a rubber hose until they tell you the key.
Right. You find the person with the key, you beat the crap out of them, or you kidnap their children. Yes, there's all sorts of ways. You've now listed two of the 94 classes of attack listed in the database, right? So if you go through, so different people use different techniques, but the basic point is firewalls protect against some things, but not all.
What is it? Rubber hose,
crystal. Right. Beat the key out. All right, these firewalls are the front gates. You need to watch for the back doors, okay? If you look at the history of the term, a firewall is a fireproof wall, uses a barrier to prevent the spread of a fire. Okay? Want to know, not intended, no firewall. Has anybody ever seen the rating on a firewall? You know what a rating on a firewall is? Burn time. That's like, if there's a flame on the other side of this level of heat, this is how long it'll take to burn through the firewall. If not, you put this firewall up, you can stay on the other side forever while there's a roaring blaze on the other side and the rest of the building falls down and you're perfectly safe, happy, you know, fat, dumb, and happy, right? That's not how it works. Okay? The firewall is there so that after the fire is blazing and the alarms have sounded and you're here, you'll have a period of time before the fire company gets there and puts out the fire where you still won't be dead. Okay?
It's the same with network firewalls. Okay? The network firewall is a barrier to prevent or slow the spread of an attack. Okay, now, I want to note, fires, very wonderful thing about fires, they seek the path of least resistance. If we have a beautiful firewall here, and there's an open door, guess what? The fire is not going to sit there trying to get through the wall, it's going to rush around the door. Which is why the door is automatically closed when this detects a fire on the other side of the firewall, unless you've blocked them open, in which case you've defeated the purpose. So, you know, it's also true of network attacks that attackers seek the path of least resistance. So in fact, if your firewall is really strong, they'll just do something else and get around your security that way. Unless that's also very strong. An example happened at AT&T. They had a firewall managed by real experts, run by these experts who are researchers and run this thing like as hard as they can, all 24 hours a day. They stay up late at night doing battle and so forth. And they discovered one day that there were packets behind the firewall that didn't belong there. And they said, oh my God, we've done something wrong with the firewall. And they examined, they searched, they looked, they figured out the packets weren't coming through the firewall. They found out somebody had a dial-up connection and the whole internet traffic was being routed through that dial-up because the firewall blocked the rest of the traffic. And they found out because of the packets on their internal network. So if it was properly engineered, they would never have found out. This would have been a permanent hole through the firewall.
So at any rate, conceptually, we have the outside here, which is on fire, and then we have the firewall that turns all that red hot fire into this black, cool inside that's perfectly all right and acceptable. We're going to be using this color scheme theme to talk about firewalls. Remember, the goal here is to keep that fire on one side and this nice, cool part on our side. All right, firewalls are used in different places. Like, for example, between the internet and your internal network. That's the most popular place. They also can and have been used between different parts of an organization. Like, for example, to protect the accounting department from the students at a university. If the university isn't doing that, they big mistake. Actually, they're probably out of business by now, so most every university is now doing this. On private links between organizations, so if you have a joint venture with some company, it's normal that the joint venture activities happen in some isolated area that's not within the network of either company. It's a separate network that's used for the joint venture that allows the parties to reach back in some safe way to get what they need from their home company, but doesn't allow the other folks to reach back, and there's a firewall that separates that out.
Firewalls have been put up at various times between national boundaries to protect countries from other countries. Anywhere flow should be restricted. Anywhere that you want to restrict the information flow, you can use a firewall. And anywhere a control plunge is desired, that's another place putting firewalls.
Where you want to do audits or track things.
We're going to be talking about internet firewalls as opposed to, you know, physical firewalls and so forth for most of our time. But I thought I would start to talk to you a little bit about internet protocols and protocol attacks. And this is my patented picture of the internet protocol suite. And we have down here somewhere at the bottom hardware devices.
Anybody have a hardware device?
You got one on the shelf here? Show me the hardware device. There you got wires. Where's the fire here?
Hardware device.
Okay, we got all sorts of hardware devices here. And through this hardware device, let's see, now some of them are hardware devices with all the electronics built into them, and that's the end of it. Other ones, like the boards that sit in these computers here, these are hardware devices that have on top of them a set of software, a set of device drivers that reside in the operating system of the computer that they're part of. And those device drivers typically move bytes between the hardware and some buffer area within the computer so that other programs in the computer that are part of the operating system can deal with the information and interpret it. Now, these days, a lot of this device drivers and, in fact, the rest of this IP stack has moved into hardware in some implementations.
But you can still think of it in the same way.
On top of the device drivers is the Internet Protocol, called IP, Internet Protocol. And the Internet Protocol is actually a suite of protocols that defines things called datagrams. And sequences of datagrams can be used for various purposes to send messages and so forth. And there are various protocols surrounding it. Address resolution protocol, I guess, is not really part of the Internet Protocol, but it is used between these hardware devices to allow them to figure out how to send information through those things. And then there's ICMP, Internet Control Message Protocol, which is a fairly low-level required part of Internet Protocol. It's necessary in order to have the control plane of Internet Protocol work. Then there is the domain name system, which does a translation between IP address numbers and names that we commonly use to talk about internet things, like the all.net site has an IP address associated with it. And if you say on your computer something like NS lookup, name server lookup, all.net, it'll tell you some IP address for it. And so if you use names instead of numbers, the DNS is necessary for your operation. And this has problems associated with it. And there's transmission control protocol, which is used for emulating what amounts to a terminal session. It guarantees or tries to guarantee various properties of the transmission. That is, that everything that is sent is received in sequence. I guess really all it tries to guarantee. That it's received is not true, but if it's received, it's received in sequence.
It actually does guarantee that everything gets sent gets received.
It tries to get things that have been sent received, but it doesn't guarantee it. But it does guarantee that you won't get anything out of sequence, or it tries hard to guarantee that. Then we have UDP, which is User Datagram Protocol, which is, I think the guarantee on UDP is that if you send the packet, it's sent.
That's the guarantee, yes.
It's, the whole internet world works by a delivery system called best effort. Okay, now what best effort means is, we'll try. That's what it means.
Sometimes it'll work, sometimes, but we'll try. We'll do our best.
All right, so here's thematic. Remember this theme. going to repeat itself. It's very important to your understanding of the issues. A datagram is just a sequence of bits sent from one place to another. You can assume that the bits were generated by the other user's program.
Okay?
So, on these wires, regardless of the electronics and what voltages it's at, by the time it hits your computer, it's a sequence of ones and zeros. And there are ones and zeros that were sent to you by somebody you probably know nothing about. You probably don't trust, or shouldn't trust, or if you do trust them, you're doing so incorrectly, especially if it's out on the internet, among this population of between 25 and 100 million people. We don't even know how many there are, much less what their names are, where they live, or much else about them. All right, the internet protocol is defined in RFC 791. RFC is a request for comment.
Okay, now, think about this. The specification for what the protocol is for how you communicate on the internet is a request for people to comment. That's all it is. It's called, hey, here's something interesting. What do you guys think about it? And that's the basis for how the internet was built. Okay? It's not somebody from a standards bureau saying, this is what we're going to do. Uh-uh. It's like, hey, Joe, what'd you come up with today? Hey, how about this new kind of protocol? It's called Send Executables Through the Internet, the SXI protocol. Here it is. Anybody want to comment on it? And after enough comments come through, they say, okay, we'll use it. That's that. That's how it works.
No assurance in there at all. There are as many as 2 to 8 different IP Internet protocol suites. They are defined by the version number, which is in the first byte of the datagram that comes in the Internet protocol. So we're normally using IP version 4. The first 8 bits are 0000, let's see if I get it right, 0100. Okay? IP version 6, 0000, 0110. Now, what happens, if I may ask, to Internet version 5? Somebody requested comments on version 5, and the comments were, yeah. So it never made it. Now, I don't want you to get the misimpression that IP version 6 is going to make it. It might make it. It's possible. But this is probably the time to tell you the story. Maybe it's not yet the time to tell you the story about why it is that railroad tracks are as wide as they are. Is this a good time for the railroad track story? By the way, who knows what happened to IP versions 1, 2, and 3?
I don't know that.
Nobody knows. Okay. They never caught on. Oh, well, this one doesn't have any buzzers. All right, so let's see. I want to impress upon you something about the nature of infrastructures and the fact that IPv4 may be with us into a lot of millennia. Maybe here for quite a long time. Almost certainly you will all die, as will your children and your children's children, before IP version 4 moves on. So the question that was brought up was, how come it is that railroad tracks are, how wide? How wide are railroad tracks? 4 foot, 11 and three quarter inches. That's a nice round number. How come railroad tracks are 4 feet, 11 and three quarter inches?
So why
is the other? No, please. The railroad tracks in the United States today are that wide, and the reason is they were that wide when the railroads were first built in the United States. Okay? In the United States, when they first built railroads, they built them that wide, and they had these big projects through the WPA, I guess, and they were building railroad tracks all over the United States and digging holes through mountains, and they wanted to use the same trains that were there before. So they use the same trains and need the same width, so they build them that width. So Now, it turns out this is not true everywhere. For example, in the ex-Soviet Union, railroad tracks are a different width. And the reason was they did not want the rest of Europe being able to go into the Soviet Union with trains in a military attack in case they decided to attack the Soviet Union. So what they did was they built the train tracks with a different gauge, a different width, so that the trains wouldn't work. So it was a defensive maneuver that they made. And of course, they now can't get shipments of goods, and that's harming them greatly in an economic sense, but that's yet another issue. So, why is it that in the United States, when we first put in railroad tracks, we made them 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide? Hello? Hi, Sherry. Am I going that way? All right, fine. Yeah, it just happens at the natural point. All right, so it turns out the reason that the railroad tracks are that wide in the United States is because when they went to build the railroads, they didn't have anybody that could build railroad engines. So they brought them from Europe on ships. So the reason it's that way in the United States is because it was that way actually in England. So the question is, why are the railroad tracks in England 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide? The answer is because in England, they've been that way for a very long time. For how long? Ever since railroads were created. So when railroads were created, they made them 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches. I think it's really 3/4, 11 and 3/4 inches wide. Because the railroads would then fit in the grooves left by the carriages and the horse-drawn buggies that used to run on the same roads as the railroads. They didn't want to redo all the roads, so they just put the tracks down in the existing grooves. So the reason is that buggies were 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide from the center of the wheel to the center of the wheel. The question is, why are buggies 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide from wheel to wheel? Not just some buggies, all the buggies. They're all the same width. Why is that? The answer is because the buggies before them were 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide, and they put grooves in the roads. And if you made a buggy that was wider, the wheels would break and they'd sway back and forth. They made them thinner, the wheels would break and the buggy would go back and forth. So they had to make them 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wider. It wouldn't work. So, all right, why did they make the buggies 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide a long time before that? Well, the answer is that they needed them to run on the roads that the Romans had built. And the Romans had built all their roads for chariots that were 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide. So that's how they had to make the buggies. Now the question, of course, is why were their chariots 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide? Okay, so the answer goes back to ancient Rome. So in ancient Rome, why did they make the chariots 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide? Anybody know the answer? Not right off. Okay, well, that's right. You happen to know because you've heard the story before. The reason is that when they made the chariots, they wanted them held to be carried by two horses. And the question of what horses ass determined that was going to be the width of the buggies is that's the width between two standard horses' asses from ancient Rome. That's how wide they had to make it so they could have two horses pull the buggy. And so the reason all current train tracks working in most of Europe and the United States are 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide is because these horses in ancient Rome were 4 foot, 11 and 3/4 inches wide. Now, what is the purpose of telling you this story? The purpose is to explain why it is that IPv4 will be here for the next several millennia. Okay, because once it's done, it becomes popular and embedded. It becomes so hard to change it, and everything starts to depend so heavily on it, that the momentum is so huge you can never change it, and that's the nature of infrastructures. That's why we have alternating current instead of direct current in our electrical power grid. Not because it's more efficient, it's not. Okay? And it's much more dangerous. Kills people a lot more easily. That's why we have it, because of something that happened century or so ago, and we're going to likely have alternating current for a very long time to come. Okay? That's why
doorways are as wide as they are. That's why tables are as high as they are. That's why chairs are the way they are. That's why windows are the way they are. That's why everything in our world is the way it is. Okay? So having understood that, this is not just some random data I'm throwing at you. This is likely to be the way the world's going to work quite some time to come. So, by the way, so we don't even have to worry about IP version 6 too much, and I don't think we're going to use all those 8 bits. Maybe somebody will come up with one. Let's see, there's maximum data frame size. Okay, if you look, there's a length field here, and the length tells you how many offsets, total length, tells you how many offsets, how many 8 byte things can be stored, can be sent in one IP datagram. Okay? So, 2 to the 16th offsets to the 17th, 18th, to the 19th bytes is the largest size for an IP datagram. How many bytes is that? How many? 500,000 bytes. That's the biggest datagram you can send. 500 kilobytes, give or take. Okay, now, see, if you look at all these fields here, one of them here is a checksum. Let's see, here it is. Checksum of the header. That tells you that that is a straight checksum. That means that the bits there are set so that the total number of bits, let's see, if you add up all words, all 16-bit words, that the sum, the binary sum, will come to zero. Right? The exclusive OR of all those bits will come to zero. Okay? So if I change the content of this packet, and I don't also change the checksum, then the packet will be treated by some systems that bother to check the checksum as being a garbage packet, and ignored or thrown away. Okay? So if a packet is going from your machine to my machine through his machine, and he wants me to ignore that packet, all you have to do is change any bit, and he's guaranteed if he changes any one bit, then the checksum will be wrong, and if I'm checking checksum, that packet will be ignored. That datagram, excuse me, will be ignored. That checksum is easily formed. If I want to change the data in the header, all I do is I change the data, I figure out the new checksum, and this all looks as valid as the previous one. Okay? No protection against forgery of anything. 32-bit is source and destination, so this is the 32-bit IP address of the source where the packet came from. This is the 32-bit address of the destination where the packet's going to. Those are the IP addresses. When we write them down, we take them byte by byte, right? 24.1.84.100, those are the 4 bytes of that address. Okay? Now, so suppose I want to send you a message that comes from somebody else. If I want to send you a datagram from somebody else, all I have to do is change those bits in the datagram header and change the checksum so that it comes out right, and you'll never know the difference. In fact, I can create a packet that claims to be from anywhere I want it to be from, shove it out into the internet, and it'll get to wherever the destination is. Well, it'll get there. Best effort will be used to get it there. It'll work most of the time. And that datagram will get to wherever it's going from, and when they look at where it came from, it'll say whatever number I put there. If I say it came from that gentleman's computer or from your computer, when they look, figure out who did that mean, rotten, nasty thing to them, that's who else they did it.
The data is up to about 0.5 megabyte.
Yeah. 2 to the 19th bytes.
That's what it looks like. It's a sequence of bits. I'm just organizing this. You'll see it. Another one is each datagram stands alone.
Okay? You shove a datagram out into the infrastructure. The infrastructure forwards it along the way until it gets wherever it's going, and it gets there, and that's it. As far as IP is concerned, it has done its job. Thank you. We're done. The packet doesn't get there. As far as IP is concerned, it's still done its job. But stop.
There is no authentication mechanism. Okay, no mechanism at all to say that this packet is authentic in any way, shape, or form. It's just a bunch of bits somebody somewhere or some computer somewhere shoved onto some wire. That's all it means.
It may be fragmented along the way. So when you send this datagram out, if there's a computer along the way that says, geez, it's a big datagram, I'll split it up into parts. They can break it up into parts and send you the parts. And it's your job to reassemble them at the other end. Then we'll get into more on that one later. There are, and this is directly from the protocol, from the RFC, request for comment. Right, this is the specification. It says there are no reliability features. Okay? If you put in a reliability feature, it is not the internet protocol. Period. Okay? It says you're not allowed to have reliability features. That's not the protocol that we wrote. The routing is not along the way. You send the packet out, it gets there, and how it gets there, you don't know. Okay? It's just going to go wherever it goes. If you send a packet from here to my house, cross town, it might go to the Middle East. No problem. It might easily, it could go to Iraq. It's Iraq up now. Maybe it couldn't go to Iraq because they may have actually severed that part. But it could go to Japan. It could go to China. It could go to Brazil. It could go to all those places. It could go to outer space. It might bounce off the moon somewhere. Certainly go to a satellite, go under the ocean. Just think, what an opportunity for travel. Your packets can go anywhere, and you don't know where. There are options for saying, take this route. You can say it has to go from this IP address to this, to this, to this, to this, to this, to this. First, it's called source routing. That's right. It's widely ignored. So if you turn on source routing, a lot of systems will just throw the packet away. Others will just ignore it. Just send them wherever they want to send it anyway. What do they care? So you can't trust it, but it's out there. And if you build your own network that you can trust the source routing in, you can use it. Good for you. There are options for labeling schemes. Like, for example, there's an option for putting a label that says this is top secret data. Of course, anybody that wants to can label it top secret data. It's just a bunch of bits. Right? A bunch of bits you put on the wire, put any bits you want. Right? Also, I think there are options for quality of service. We all know there is no quality. Let's talk a little bit about this fragmentation process where our datagrams get broken up into smaller datagrams that then get reassembled at the other end. See, it turns out packets don't always fit into the media that you send them in. For example, Ethernet has a maximum byte size per Ethernet thing, Ethernet packet. Are they called packets in an Ethernet? I think they are. The maximum size for an Ethernet packet is 1,500 bytes. I could be off, but I think that's about right. 1,500 bytes. So if I send you a datagram that has 500,000 bytes and it goes to an Ethernet, it's not going to make it, right? It won't fit. So to make it fit, the datagrams get split across multiple packets, okay? SIP lines, serial line internet protocol. SIP lines typically have 56 bytes of length. So a big datagram has to get split into a lot of sub-datagrams. It has to be made into a lot of fragments to go through that kind of a wire. This problem is solved by fragmenting of the packets. They split the packets into many parts, send the parts separately and independently, and reassemble them at the other end. Now, all the parts don't necessarily go the same way. One part could go to Israel. Another part could go to Japan. Another part could go to Moscow. Another part could go, like, directly to my house. It'd be nice if all the parts went right to my house, but you don't get that choice. Okay, this is all done by this flag and a fragment offset. Oh, went too far. No, I didn't. I went the wrong way. There we go. Here's an example of how IP fragmentation can be exploited in an attack. Okay, this is an IP header, Internet Protocol header, that specifies an offset invite for the fragment. And it has the proper bit set with a SYN packet, which means it's the first packet in a series of packets. And it has a fragment bit set that says this is a fragmented datagram. And it has a fragment offset that tells it what part of this large datagram this little datagram is. Okay? And in this case, this is the first fragment, and it says it's going to TCP port 80, which is the World Wide Web Service, HTTP. Now, most firewalls are configured to allow web service to work, even though they might not be allowing, say, telnet to work.
So you can use the web service, but you can't log into the computer. It's a typical firewall configuration.
So suppose the first packet says, I'm at port 80 on an HTTP protocol.
Okay, the firewall is going to let it through. And it's going to let through the rest of the sequence of datagrams, portions of datagrams, so they can all be reassembled at the end.
Suppose the second one says, my fragment, instead of being somewhere down the middle of this datagram, is right up at the top. But it says, hey, I'm not a synchronization packet, which means it'll pass through typical firewall configurations automatically, because it's the second packet in the series. We've already checked it, and it is allowed. And it's going to have a fragment offset, for example, 0 or some other number, and that fragment's going to overlay some other data on top of this port 80. In fact, it's going to say port 23. So what happens is the datagram gets split apart, but instead of doing it in the right way, it's done by this attacker who splits it apart in a special way so that the first packet gets through and the second packet gets through and overlays part of the first packet, causing it to become corrupted and allow a function that wouldn't otherwise be allowed. I'll show you this. So here's the resulting reassembled packet. Okay, it has a thin bit set. It's going to port 23, but it got through the firewall because each of those separate datagrams could have gotten through. Okay? By the way, in May 95, several vendors found this vulnerability in firewalls and routers. Okay? Okay. All sorts of vendors had firewalls they thought were secure against this. All of a sudden, one day, somebody noticed this. Oh, no! They're all wrong. Essentially, every firewall, or a large portion of all the firewalls in the world, all of a sudden, failed to perform their function that day. And many of them failed to perform that function for some time thereafter. Here's a picture for them. Here's the original packet, which is nice and blue. That's a good packet. Here's this bad overlay. And it's overlaying that part here where the decision was made that said it's all right. But it's overlaying it after the decision was made in the receiving system, and the resulting datagram allows coming. Okay, this comes to the question then of where do we reassemble the packets? If we have fragmented datagrams, we have to decide where to reassemble them. Okay, and what weaknesses do we get from reassembling it in different places? Okay, I can reassemble it inside the firewall or at the firewall or somewhere else. Let's look at it. Suppose I assemble the whole datagram before the decision is made to pass or stop. So at the firewall, before I let it through the firewall, I reassemble the whole thing. Right? That'll prevent this attack. However, what's the largest size of the datagram? How much?
500K, right? 500, half a megabyte. So, suppose I send you almost all of that datagram. I'll send you 499 kilobytes. Send you 499 kilobytes, but I'm not going to send you that last kilobyte. Then I'm going to start another datagram, and I'm going to send you all but the last little bit of it. And I'm going to start another one and send you all but the last little bit. I'm going to keep doing that. Denial of service. You'll never be able to reassemble them all. You'll fill your whole memory up with all these fragments from different datagrams that are never going to get reassembled. So now it gets to where you run out of memory and you can't do anything anymore. You can't reassemble anything. So I can deny services. Depending on how many bits per second can be shoved over that wire, okay, depending on how many bits you can shove per second, that tells you how much memory you can consume in the firewall per second. Now, suppose I'm running on an infrastructure like you have here, 10 million bits per second, most of it? So that's a million bytes per second. How much memory do you have in your computer at the firewall? Say it's 128 megabytes? 32 megabytes. Oh, it's smaller. That's right. I'll give you 100. I'll give you 128 megabytes. It's no problem. It's only four times the number of seconds, right? How many seconds does it take before that firewall is out of memory? Come on, make the calculation. 128. 10 seconds? 100 seconds? Okay. So, and once I've done that, I can just keep shoving these things at you, and whatever you do, you're going to be running out of memory all the time.
Okay? So if you're going to reassemble them here, that's a big problem. How about if we don't allow overlay fragments? That's another option. No of these fragments. You have to store the fragment starts and extents instead of, so that means that just to track.
Right. I'm going to store the whole thing, but I'm not going to allow anything to overlay. So instead of storing it all, I'll forward it off, but never allow an overlay to occur. So that I'll keep the beginning and the length of each one of them, store that data until it's all completed. Okay? I'll just keep the list. Okay?
So for n fragments, I have something like 2n space. Okay? And I have to compare each new fragment to see whether it overlays into any of those other fragments.
Okay? So think about it now. Think about your algorithm. What's the computation time when I have 10,000 fragments for figuring out whether that next fragment overlays anything else? If I do a linear search, it's pretty bad. It means the whole firewall gets slow as molasses if I send lots and lots of fragments at it. Another alternative is I can keep it sorted, and I can do some sort of a binary search. So I need to have sorting algorithms and binary search algorithms stuck in the firewall. And nobody does that right now, but you could do that.
So, part of this here, now you're trading space for time. Instead of storing all this space, you're storing all this time, and consuming all this time with a lot of fragmented packets will also slow your firewall down to where you can't handle 100 million bits per second. Just remember, datagrams just sequence bits sent from one place to another. Bits are generated by the other user's program. You can't tell a fake one from a real one. Okay? Anyone with an IP link can fake packets, and forgery tools are freely available. In fact, probably in this room, there are 30 or 40, maybe 100 tools that allow you to forge IP addresses. And most internet service providers don't stop forgeries, so they flow freely through the internet. From a fake source address. What are some good uses for What are some applications of being able to lie in this way in the internet, forging IP addresses? Dunnigan and Nopi
wrote a wonderful book called Deception.
I think it's Deception and the Warfare, and there's more to the title than that. I don't remember all the details. And they categorize deceptions into concealment, camouflage, false and planted information, ruses, displays, demonstrations, fake lies, and insights. And we'll think in terms of corruption, denial, leakage, and liability, in terms of the impact that it can have on our system.
What's the name of that book, Fred?
I think it's called Victory and Deceit. Deception in Warfare, something like that. Victory and Deceit. By Dunnigan and Nopi.
If you look on the all.net website, you can find it there in a number of articles. If you look in the article, a note on the role of deception and information protection, I'm sure it has the citation.
It turns out we can do some fairly trivial things to defend against IP address forgery. Here are some examples. One of the kinds of IP address forgery that happens is forgeries involving the sets of IP addresses that don't really exist. That is, there are IP addresses that are specified as addresses not to be used except internally. So they're only for use within your own internal network. They're not for use on the internet as a whole.
For example, the 127 Class A network, 127.anything.anything.anything is not supposed to ever be able to enter or leave any area. In fact, it's almost always used strictly for your computer to talk to itself. The loopback interface. Now, is there some reason you can't shove a packet out into the internet that has a thumb address being 127.0.0.1? No reason at all. If I want to get anything back, that's another question. Somebody will get something back, and we'll get to that a little bit later.
With the local address, there's also invalid IP addresses, like 0.0.0.0.
It's not a valid IP address. Okay. Anybody know what happens if you send a packet out that has the 0.0.0.0 IP address as its source? Huh?
Do you know? No, you don't know. Nobody knows. Anything could happen. That's correct. That's the correct answer. The answer is anything could happen. Yeah. I mean, probably the moon won't crash into the Earth over it, but who knows? Maybe the whole internet would collapse. It could happen. Right? If the answer to my question is, I don't know, then the answer is not good enough. Because if you get one of these, what's your firewall going to do? What's your system going to do? If you don't know, and I can certainly send one, then that's not very good. You've got to find this out. How about anything.0? What happens if I send a packet that has a destination address of anything with a .0? What happens to it? Yeah, what happens to the destination?
Zero is the destination, usually the address of that one.
What happens if you get a packet? Who knows? Anything could happen. Remember this phrase. Anything could happen. Repeat after me. Anything could happen. Go. Anything could happen. This is our mantra for IP. Anything could happen. That's the truth of IP. Okay. How about the address 255.255.255.255?
Everybody
in the whole internet would get it? That's what you think?
Nobody
filter. Oh, suppose we try to filter on it. You know what the firewall, you know what the filtering rules look like if you have a 255? 255 is used to mean block everything. So nobody blocks 255 and they wouldn't get any traffic. So what happens if I send something to 255.255.255.255? Nobody knows. Anything could happen. Thank you. Say it louder, all together.
Anything could happen.
Would you like to do an experiment?
Yeah.
All right, make sure that the firewall is temporarily disconnected so you're in an isolated land when it happens. I don't think anything bad will happen, but I will tell you that nobody knows. Nobody knows. Anything can happen. All right, private subnet. RFC, request for comments 1597, declared because somebody decided they wanted to. Actually, they wanted other people to comment on it, so nobody did, sir. That's what we do. Anything that starts with a 10, 10.anything is a private subnet. It's not supposed to be routed over the internet. What happens if I shove a packet out into the internet with a destination address of 10.something? That's not true. Anything could not happen. Who knows what happens? I'll tell you what I think happens. It's my opinion based on some experience. It goes a couple of hops, and then finally, nobody knows where to send it, it reaches the maximum hop count and disappears.
Yeah,
it'll hit a router with no route and disappear. So it maybe brings around a little bit, short lifetime, a few hundred milliseconds, maybe a second, might live a second. What happens if I send lots and lots of them? Right. Now, here's where we come to the mantra. Anything could happen. That's if it's a source address. Sorry, that's a destination address. What if it's a source address? Then what happens? Right, it gets to wherever it was going to, and the replies go to that address. So where do they go? Who knows? There are a couple of possibilities. One is they try and send it off into the internet, in which case it will bing around like the other one. But how about this one? How about if they're using the 10 net internally? It'll go to one of their addresses. They'll reply to some other internal machine and say, yes, how can I help you? What do you mean, how can I help you? They'll probably have an exchange protocol to say, what happened? I don't know. Did you say something? Did I say something? Finally, they'll agree nobody said anything. But it might take 20 or 30 packets, you know, depending on what you say. It might take a lot worse, and we'll get to that. Same with 172.16 through 32. Those are the Class B private subnets, and there's a Class... And there's one more, 192.168.anything.anything. Do not ask me how they came up with these numbers. They came up with these numbers because the person who wrote RFC 1597 wrote down those numbers. That's what it is. Go to the packet and look at the number of bits. I believe it's eight bits? Yeah, 8 bits. in theory, but I think actually 32 and 64 is probably the real max.
Because a lot of the boxes don't use all those things. But 255 is the theoretical maximum number of boxes.
Okay, now you can defend against these stupid patents. So if you configure your firewall properly, you won't have problems with these stupid patents. Okay, serial defenses. If it's an internal source, don't pass it out now. If it's an internal destination, don't pass it out now. An external source, don't let it in, and don't let it out. An external destination, don't let it in.
That's all you have to do. You have a question.
Okay. Alright, so what you do is you just don't route these things. You refuse to send them where they don't belong. And that's what you can do. If you're in an internet service provider, you can reject a thing from a client that doesn't come from a source address that goes to that client. That'll prevent them making forgeries that pass through your infrastructure. If it goes to an ISP destination, you can refuse to take it from the backbone. So if somebody tries to send you something that doesn't belong to any of your addresses, you say, sorry, not me, I'm not here. Okay. If it's from and so forth. So basically, you just don't allow darn stuff to happen that way. If you did this, there wouldn't very much left to report it. It wouldn't be able to do it. Nobody would route it unless they were not reported. They got to be like U4 hacks from Dynasty. Come back to your Oracle network and go to talk. And then that one do the same thing. From an ISP, not in the ISP range, you don't take it. Deal. That's the way the internet works. There's backbone, there's internet service providers, and then there's sort of end users and end networks. And if they all did this, it would eliminate the vast majority of IP addresses.
Okay, remember our mantra here? The datagram is just a sequence of bits. That's from one place to another, the bits are generated by another user program. Address resolution protocol, ARP. This is how we resolve addresses, translate between IP address and Ethernet address. So if you're on Ethernet,
here's your Ethernet here as wires. Then when you send a packet on the Ethernet runs in packets, not a datagram. When you send your datagram through the Ethernet, it gets put into a packet on Ethernet. The Ethernet uses MAC message authentication control, whatever it is, addresses associated with each Ethernet card. So what happens is it does the address resolution protocol. It says, I have an IP address. Who has 1.2.3.4? And another box says, I have 1.2.3.4. And then the first box says, okay, I'll send it on an Ethernet packet that has your MAC address in the header. So your box will know to pick up that packet process, and everybody else will ignore it. Okay? So, and normally these results are hashed. You don't have to keep asking and asking. Yeah, so why don't you remember it for a while? Yeah, every once in a while, yeah.
More of a need to guess, yeah. So, very simple to fork the IP address, you know that. And suppose you have a network, and I put a box in the middle of the network, so all the packets on two box.
And I make it real transparent. Like it can fake MAC addresses and ARP answers, all that stuff.
Suppose I say that the ARP address for that guy is really,
it's not going to take it. And I don't let them answer. I block their answer in the meanwhile. From now on, you believe that IP address is me, and you'll send it here. In fact, this is very handy because I now have a whole network.
I have a whole Class C network. Resolves all the MAC addresses, all the ARP requests come to the same IP address. So it came to the same box, which has all different IP addresses. So if the only box was to put itself. So anybody from the outside can't tell. It's all perfect. Alright, so there's all sorts of things you could do with this degree active tapping that would be a forgery that would be not discernible, even if people look at the MAC address to figure out whether the MAC address was being ported. Even if they try to use address resolution protocol to get routed the wrong way. I caught things throughout the wrong way that way. Also. The NFTCP, Transmission Control Protocol Datagrams, that's defined by RFC 793. By the way, the RFCs are all available on the internet. Actually, the only way you get information about the internet is from the internet.
So if you can't get the internet to work, don't worry. Just use the internet to get the information to get the internet to work. There's a problem there. This translates into a general purpose problem. If you have information you need in order to run your systems, and your systems are down, then you won't have the information that you need in order to get your systems to run. So this is one of the things we encounter a lot in information security is because we depend so heavily on the information system that we forget to write on a piece of paper. So when push comes to shove, we can't get any of it to work because we don't have a piece of paper. It's all on the computer, which isn't working because we don't have the information we need to get working.
TCP, defined by that RFC, well, of course on the internet, it provides what's called a reliable virtual service, sequenced and retransmitted if needed, and recombined and sequenced at the other end. They act like a terminal, input and output to a process. That's what they were designed
actually is a terminal protocol. It's fake being a terminal so I can log into another computer. Even though it's on my computer somewhere else. That's what it's for. You have a local and remote hosted port pair. So you have a local host, a local port, a remote hosted remote port.
These things go into a diagram, and that's how you set up these channels to communicate with each other.
So inside the IP diagram, inside the big blue box, we have the TCP protocol. It's after the header. The header says this is a TCP diagram. The intercom has local host, local port, remote host, remote port, and a bunch of data in order to trade.
Data and synchronization.
Obviously, if you need a port, you just change the local host, send it to the lock. Okay, another host. Usually a hotjet. In most cases, there have been some defenses put in place against that these days.
But basically, if I want to get in the middle of the session, all I need to do is listen to the session and jump in the middle. And throw off the guy on one end and jump in the middle and say, hey, that's me now. See? And just like you're having a conversation with somebody on the telephone, and they're able to fake the voice, because there's no voice, right?
Over the internet, so my computer talks in the same voice as your computer. So I just sort of jump in the middle of that phone conversation and start talking, and here we are. In fact, if I'm clever, I can have two people jump in, one talking to each side, not talking to each other. And each side believes the conversation is still going on the regular way. And every once in a while, I insert something. You know, so, okay, you're tired of typing, just thinking about something, so I'll just type a bunch of commands and not let the answers get back to you. But as soon as you're ready to type something, I'll put the computer back in the same place it was before, and you can continue typing your commands. And you'll never know the difference.
Okay.
Active tapping is very straightforward. And a lot of people know how to do it. In fact, they're now off the internet attacks, but we'll do this for you. Just get one for free. So one of the archives of attacking, you get one for free. You guys probably have experience on it. It reports low port number 1024, in theory, needs root access, but these days almost everybody has their own system.
So root access means to say, I'm rooting.
It's not exactly secure. There are all sorts of issues associated with port assignments. In fact, I now have the port 11111 and 365. I own those two IP TCP ports, also the UDP ports. So now think about it. We have how many port numbers? 65,000 port numbers. How many internet users are there? A couple hundred million. So if everybody just wanted one port number for themselves, too bad. Not actually very many port numbers. In fact, we're starting to run into lots and lots of protocols people are coming up with for all sorts of applications. And we're not far from the point where we may run out of protocols. We have to start figuring out what we do for new standard service protocols. But of course, it doesn't matter because the bad guys are starting to overlay things on top of other things anyway. So ultimately, it's likely to come down to these aren't recognized numbers anymore. Probably I call up and I say, gee, what port number are you running Sonnet on? And they answer you, we're not. No, there's a port called Sonnet. That's port supply services today. Remember, of course, the major is just because of it. That's one place or another that's generated by the other user's program. So here's the typical TCP protocol sequence in a simplified form. Basically, I send out a packet that says, it has a SYN bit that says, synchronize, hello, I'm trying to start a communication. You send back something that says, I got your hello and I acknowledge it. And then I say, I got your acknowledgement and I'm acknowledging it, here's some data. And then they say, I acknowledge that last acknowledgement, here's your response. And the next guy says, I acknowledge that and I send this back. Okay, that's how it works. Now, so there are acknowledgement numbers that allow you to keep track of the traffic so you know which the packet sequences are so you keep things in order, reassemble it properly. And so you know that you're in the same conversation. And so the SYN and ACK are in the IP header. The SYN is in the data packet. There's some vulnerabilities you should know about. One of the session hijacking, if I can figure out the proper number put into my acknowledgement, then I can just take over the session. That's what I mentioned before. It's not quite the trivial that I mentioned. Active tapping, you can get in the middle of the session. Packet corruption. Just change a bit in the packet. Don't follow me here. I can take your packet that runs through my box and just substitute whatever command you were going to type in with rm space minus rf space slash. I just shove that into the packet, make the checks on the packet. That's it. Your SYN, your ACK, your sequence numbers, it all works just fine. I just substitute my command for your command. There's nothing except a simple checksum that verifies that that's right. All I have to do is be able to modify the history, and don't worry, you don't have to rush. There's no rush because almost always it'll be at least 5 to 10 seconds before it gives up on packet. And if you can't write a program, it'll go substitute one command for another and calculate a checksum in 5 to 10 seconds. And you can do that in Visual Basic, no problem. You could probably do it by hand. If you're smart,
you have a calculator, you can probably do it by hand.
There's open channel denial services. What I can do is I can just send out a bunch of SYN packets and never acknowledge. So I sent out a synchronization packet and you said, okay, I'm ready to talk to you. I'm listening.
and no response ever comes. This is called a SID flood in the terminology of the day. I just told you with these synchronizations, you've set up a whole bunch of channels, you're waiting for communications, typically you're limited to 10,024, some fixed number of these things that you have space in your kernel to store to remember these sessions are ongoing. And if I can send you enough of these in a short enough period of time, your kernel space will be filled up and you'll not be able to accept any more connections. Now you throw them out, denial of service, right? You throw them out after a period of time, so if I just keep sending you more at the proper rate, you'll retain that denial of service indefinitely. So there are a variety of defenses against this. I can actually, instead of doing a SIN file, I can actually open a communication channel. I can say, synchronize, you acknowledge, I acknowledge, we're talking to each other. Now we don't say anything. So, it's the same as a SIN flood, except I've gotten your acknowledgement and acknowledged it. And I have all these channels open. So eventually, time out, as long as I keep doing this at fast enough rate, your services will be dominated by me. The end of the story. Denial of service.
As long as you want to keep accepting.
Then there's SIN flood. How this whole protocol is with SIN packet. I say, done. Thank you. And then the conversation ends, even if the other guy didn't know the conversation was supposed to end. So it's supposed to just shove a SIN packet in. You're having a conversation, I shove in a SIN. Well, done. Conversation over. You're so clunky, they're not listening. Alright, so you can send a reset packet. Reset, sorry. End of conversation. Now you might need this acknowledgement number, one of these numbers, but in case I don't have the number, I can just try them all. Right, just send you a few million, a little teeny packet. Just send you a few million, cover the portion of the space you might be in, and be lucky, I'll shut down your conversation. Or you can do very much, isn't it? If I'm sending these things all the time, I can just keep knocking out your conversations all the time.
In fact, if I send them in a space, in a number space, that's shortly following that initial SIN act, you'll be able to start conversations, but a few hundred bytes into them, they'll all be shut down.
And it's very easy to cover that space, because there aren't that many numbers in that space.
This is one of the things I hear very often, especially from people that are inexperienced or people that believe in technology and haven't been through the crap. It's not always been the truth. But it seems so complicated. Okay? It does. It seems like, it's so complicated. Figure out I have to change a packet in 2 milliseconds. I have to do this. I have to change this. I have to recalculate the system. No, it would never go that much trouble. Many people believe they're safe from complex attacks because these attacks are hard to implement. Understanding the basic technology that if one person, one bad person, they can probably do it one time. They can publish it out on the internet, and thousands or tens of thousands of bad actors will have it in 10 minutes. And from then on, anybody in the world that wants to do it can do it. So that's the thing about information technology is mass production is key. Okay? If one person goes to the trouble, and they give away, then the most complex technical attack you could ever imagine becomes absolutely trivial for everybody else in the world. And that's what's happened.
It's the advantage of information technology.